This is Geek Gab with your hosts, Dornall and me, Daddy Warpig. We are back. Geek Gab for Monday, April 22nd, 2024. My brain there was trying to trick me into saying 2022. No. It's 2024.
Too many twos, not enough twos.
Happy 22nd of April. There was something important that happened today, but now I can't remember it.
Couldn't have been that important.
No, there was literally I can't remember. I just saw it today. There was a movie that was released or something.
Hey, that's interesting. Just so that know.
WKRP in Cincinnati broadcast its final episode yesterday, 30-something, 40-something years ago. That's what it was. It was the 21st, not the 22nd. That's my bad. I have stunned you. I've stunned him into silence.
You've stunned me because we're working through technical difficulties. I have no idea what the heck is wrong with StreamYard or YouTube, but it was a full 60-second delay. Folks, we waited for the show to start, and I'm sorry if the last couple of episodes got cut off at the beginning. I don't know what's going on with the streaming platforms, but even today, I believe it got cut off. Isn't that terrible?
Well,
sort of.
Can't do anything about it.
And we're not surprised much at all on the internet.
I want to start the show by saying are we broadcasting now in a part that's going to be recorded?
Yes.
Okay. So let's redo this. I may repeat this, but this is Geek Gab, folks. We are your hosts, Dornall and Daddy Warpig. We are back. I want to thank everyone who's listening live. I want to thank everyone who will listen later. And this is the show for Monday, April 22nd, 2024, episode 343. We're going to be talking about Space Wars today. But I want to start the show by grateful that we've been able to do this for the last long time. Grateful for everybody who listens and tunes in, and grateful for my co-host for being willing to set this up this week, despite all the technical difficulties we had.
It has been and will continue to be a great honor and pleasure.
So, but you had a couple of things before we get to in Space Wars, because I watched the second half of Rebel Moon, or Rebel Moon Part 2, The Scar Giver. And I was going to reacquaint myself with the first half by watching Rebel Moon Part 1, whatever that was called. But I just didn't want to do it. I just didn't feel like it. Because I've seen it already and I didn't want to do it again. And we never did a review of it on the show. We promised to, but the one show we were going to, we never had a chance to because we ran out of time. So we're going to review both of those. And we also, we're going to review Netflix's The Three Body Problem. And we're also going to review sort of another show called Three Body on Amazon Prime, which is Tencent's original Chinese language, Chinese produced version of the same book, Three Body, problem, which I tried to watch. So, but before we get to all of that, we had this week a Battle Bronstein for Trollopolis that we wanted to talk about.
That's right. Trollopolis, the infamous Dungeons & Dragons setting. We took a break from our normal scheduled dungeoneering. And I've been Dungeon Master for, I think, the past 2 months. We took a break from that, and we went back to Machador, where the inimitable Macho Mandalf ran for us a Battle Bronstein, which is sort of like a game of diplomacy and a war game all rolled into one, where we sat down for 4 hours, and what did we do? Well, let me share with you a little nerdy map of the area, and I hope you can see that if you're on YouTube. There's a portion of the world called the Bandit Mountains, and there are various cities sort of modeled after the Swiss Alps throughout these mountains. But there's also castles and caves and keeps of bad guys, as well as the aforementioned bandits. And so our game master, Macho Mandalf, set up a really cool scenario where he handed out to most of the players. Most of the players were playing merchant caravans, and they were laden with a bunch of goods and money, and other players were mercenary companies, and even other players were antagonists of some kind, antagonists to the merchant caravan. So he gave everybody a different starting place on the map, and he gave everybody their basic units, what sort of people they had. And he let them make up the name of the, you know, who they were, what their name was. And in true Trollopolis fashion, before we even got to the game, everybody really got into it by making up their own factions. I would love to share with you some of the flyers that they made. And if you're listening later, sorry that you can't see this. Check it out on YouTube. Check it out on Twitter. I'll put the link in the chat. I'll post the link in the in the show description. We had someone create a beautiful flyer for the Corvus Court. You know, what kind of bird-themed wise man was this? Secret insights, wise of wing, informed opinion, Orb the Oracular. That was played by Dunder Moose. The Irish Mercenary Company. Bob plays an Irish fighter named after the wrestler Sheamus, and he puts up a flyer with green colors and beers and everything, you know, and he's one of the mercenary companies who got paid to help protect the merchant caravans. East Machador Trading Conglomerate with a, you know, an old time flyer advertising their you know, looking for mercenaries to buy. I actually played the Machador's forces from Minas Mandalf. I was given 120 Pegasus Knights called the Pegasus Corps, 6th Company. We all got into making these different factions and different characters, and the Discord lit up with all these cool, you know, images and flyers and things that we were making. So even before the game started, we were wheeling and dealing, and people were arranging ahead of time. Yeah, I'm going to purchase 100 of your soldiers, and we're going to take this route, and we're going to meet up at this castle and move together, that sort of thing. So the plotting already happened the week before. And then the night of, we finally played it. And there was, first of all, there was a great convergence in the middle of the mountains as everybody's routes sort of took them towards the same area. And then mysteriously, one by one, the vulnerable merchant caravans were being picked off in the middle of the night when they weren't stopped somewhere safely. And I'm not doing it justice, but there's constant messages going on in the back channel. People are jumping into different Discord channels to make deals. And there was a couple of times when the dungeon master takes one or two other players into a private channel and they're gone for like half an hour. We know something bad is happening. Sure enough, there is a fight somewhere in the mountains. And you know, I think the Eastern Trading Company got eliminated and there was another trading company that got eliminated. And I don't have the name right in front of me. Very cool stuff. What happened was at the end of the night, after several battles and moving through the mountains, one trading company did make it through the mountains in one piece, whereas the two of them, sorry, out of four players, two were eliminated. One of them was eliminated by the Master of Winter, an evil monk, and his white dragon and yetis and ice toads in the mountains. Another one was eliminated by Corvus, Orb of the Oracular, literally just assassinated the guy with a lightning bolt when he thought he was safe. And a third expedition, there were two expeditions that were lost to the Master of Winter, actually. But one of the merchant caravans actually made it out, and that was played by Fluid the Druid. And the Comitatus Rusticorum. So congratulations to him for sort of making it out, because ultimately, when the DM tallied up the score, he had won the whole thing by virtue of actually getting the big payday for making it out of the mountains safely. That all sounds all wild and confusing and everything, but it was run really well by the Dungeon Master, because he had an idea of travel times throughout the mountains, and we just played by day. Okay, well, give me your orders for day one, give me your orders for day two, give me your orders for day three. We went through 5 or 6 days in 4 hours of game time. Everybody seemed to have a lot of fun, and at the end of the day, I'm not sure how much we shook up the status quo of the game world, but it's not things have happened. Like one of the merchants that was wiped out was a point of contact for the regular adventuring group, so we no longer have access to that guy for buying and selling our wares. A new faction entered the game thanks to Bradford C. Walker, friend of the show. He showed up and he played a bandit group, and he made a deal with one of the other players, and who knows what's going to come out of that. We're going to find out later when we play the game. And if you've been following the BroSR, if you've been following D&D and Twitter and those guys, you know what's going on with these Battle Bronsteins. For anybody who's new to this sort of thing, the idea is that every once in a while, when you want to do some big army wargaming, or if the campaign world that you're in is a little stale and you want to shake up the status quo, or you just have a crazy idea for some event that you want to do, you get everybody together, all the players together, and you say, guys, this week we're not going to play a regular game with your regular characters. We're going to put those guys in the background for now, and we're going to play these big factions. Everybody's going to get an army or a special character, and we're going to put you on this map, and everybody's going to fight over something. And combining the free form wheeling and dealing and talking of a diplomacy game or the original Brownstein, combining that with the advanced Dungeons and Dragons rules, which handle all of your combat, all of your movement, and it gives you all your spell lists and ability lists and magic items and things, you know, using the AD&D as your core rules and playing a Brownstein with it, it really makes the greater world come alive that much more for that one session. And it's for those of us who haven't been playing for 60 years, it's a taste of what a mature campaign could be like if you had many, many high-level players playing at that high domain level. So it serves a lot of purposes. And the argument or the description coming from the people doing it, and Jeffro, thank you, Jeffro, for holding the first battle Brownstein and sort of spelling it out for everybody, is this sort of game is integral to Dungeons and Dragons. This is the sort of game that you get to play in a mature campaign when you have multiple people with different forces facing off against each other. And congrats to Flew the Druid for winning this one. I really want to appreciate Macho Mandelf. He really knocked it out of the park. He ran this thing smooth and efficiently, and we all had a great time playing it. So that's it. That's what happened in our last game, and it was so unusual, so unlike your usual sessions. I just had to talk about it.
Awesome. Is there anything, if you were going to do this as a game master, is there anything you would have done differently?
Let's see. I am not sure about that, actually. The only thing that was a little awkward was that my faction, the Pegasus Knight, had a movement rate that was so much faster than everybody else's. So each caravan would be able to move three spaces through the mountains in a day, right? And I could move my guys five spaces in an hour, which is an amazing advantage. I wish I'd been able to take better advantage of it, but the movement rates were so different that I think the ref was unable to really, I mean, in other words, I'd be taking something like 8 to 12 actions more than everybody else, and I don't think he had the time to really play it that way. So I don't know if having one faction that different from the others was possible for him to really use. But that's a minor thing. I would, if I were to do something like that, it would be roughly the same. You've got a small area, you've got different factions with competing objectives, and let them go at it. Now, one thing that I hinted at the beginning that I'll make more explicit is there were teams. It didn't seem like that when he first explained it, but there were teams, right? The four merchant companies had great incentive to work together. And the mercenary companies were interested in making money off of them by hiring out their services, but that wasn't an antagonistic relationship. The mercenary companies weren't, for example, weren't going to get win the game by killing all the merchants and stealing their stuff, right? It was a cooperative endeavor. But then there's the antagonists, which were the Master of Winter, the Kenku, led by Dunder Moose, the Oracle who killed one of the merchant caravans. There was Bradford's bandit crew. We didn't learn much about them. And there was no sign of the big red dragon. We don't know if he's a problem. So it was actually a team game, if you really think about it. But there's only one individual winner. And that was interesting. I don't know if I'd do it that way again, but that made it for a really interesting game. I think I do have an idea for a Battle Bronstein that I would run if I've answered your question adequately,
Well, I had
which
a
is
follow-up question, but go ahead, because I'm interested. I want to hear that.
I think that it's time that we put the spotlight on alignment. At For low-level characters, alignment is in the background. It doesn't seem terribly important, other than to limit which classes you play. But at a high level, when you're talking about armies and domains and the types of people that you recruit to your domain, they tend to match your alignment. So I think the next Battle Bronstein ought to focus on alignment. I would even go so far as to limit the game to 9 players and assign each of them an alignment and see which alignment wins at the end, so that you have built in tenuous alliances, but you also have built in enmities. And speaking of the cooperative nature, Fluids here, Brian Renninger says, yes, I couldn't have done it without the Irish, but I paid dearly for their help. And for my part, and I know we're digressing back to the Machador Bronstein, I charge too much for my services because the two mercenary companies that perished balked at my prices. And they would have lived if they had 60 Pegasus Knights with them. Totally different ball game. So yeah, hats off to you. But to go back to my thought, yeah, I think alignment needs to play a bigger role in this next one. And either that or, booze and drugs when Fluid does his gangbusters. But we'll talk about that later. So what do you think about that?
Well, what I'm thinking about is most of the Bronstein things have been, like Brovenloft. They've been these big, huge, mega, month-long events, and then there was Decemberk, that was another month-long event. Is this the first one that was done entirely in one night that was still covering a lot of time, but everything was adjudicated in one night?
It's the most effective so far. The Battle Bronstein that Jeffro ran in Who Caresville, we did it in one night. It was like a 6-hour session, but it only covered, I think, 2 days, because we had the red kegger and it was so much fun. We played that out and then it was over, right? This one, it was six, I think it was 6 days. 6 days of game. It could have been a whole week. And we played it out in 4 hours. Like, it was really well done.
So do you think it's because because the techniques for running it are getting better, or because Burosar is understanding how to get them, how to run these better, or what?
Oh, that's a great question. It's tough to separate those things, but I will say that most of the players in this played in the Who Caresville game, and so they have experience doing it. A couple of the antagonists, the Master of Winter, and if I'm not mistaken, Bradford Walker, they have war game experience, so they brought that to the table. And the referee, Macho Mandalf, is very intelligent, and he ran it very well. So it's a little bit of all of those things, Warpig. It's a little bit of experience, a little bit of straight up competency, and a little bit of, we're just the right people for it. I mean, we play real D&D. I don't know how else to say it. Although to Bradford Walker's point, there are some unresolved actions left to play out. Similar to the Who Caresville Bronstein. Some stuff just wasn't interesting enough or important enough or relevant enough to resolve right away. So I'm looking forward to see what comes out of that. And we might even see it this week, because we're going back to regular gaming and we're going back to the Bandit Mountains to see what life is like there now.
So will this have a large impact going forward on play in the Bandit Mountains?
Yeah, it really depends on what you mean by large. There are certain things that I will say it has significantly changed, because we lost one of our merchant contacts, as I said, and the Master of Winter, the main antagonist, I think he was the actual winner of the Battle Bronstein. He's probably doubled his treasure. And he didn't take any losses. And we've got a bandit group threatening the Irish up in the northern part of the mountain. That's Bradford Walker. So who knows what's going to come out of that? Large, I can't say. Maybe not too much for the low-level adventurers, but the game state's changed, for sure.
All right, I think that's all the questions I had.
We're going to sign you up for the next one, Warpig. You can't miss it this time.
I actually showed up for the beginning, but then when I realized it wasn't a regular gaming session, I dipped out, because I was like, I don't have anything going on in this. I'm going to go do something else. And that's when I went off and watched Rebel Moon.
Very good. Very good.
I was like, so if I can't play, I might as well do something, get ready for the show.
Hey, Simon Hogwood. Glad you're here. Good to see you guys listening in the chat. I think now that everybody's here, I think it's time to start talking about that stuff, Daddy Warpig. You want to tell us about Rebel Moon first, or the other thing?
I really don't.
That's okay. We can keep talking about D&D. I'll go change the stream title later.
No. I mean, that's mean. I just... let's...
I love it. This is the best way to start.
Man, Rebel Moon, boy, that Zack Snyder. You got to understand, it gets shakier every time I'm forced to watch a Zack Snyder movie and then describe myself as a big Zack Snyder fan, because the point in time at which I have to assert that I have stopped counting Zack Snyder movies that I like is getting further and further in the past. And so it's like, oh yeah, except everything after, you know, I don't know, 2011 or 2012. So I don't know that I can count myself as a big Zack Snyder fan anymore, but I'm really a big fan of his 2004, you know, Dawn of the Dead, or is it Day of the Dead, whatever it is. Dawn of the Dead, his mall zombie
Dawn movie. Of the
I
Dead.
Love that movie. I love 300. I think that's a fabulous movie. I'm a big fan of Watchmen. I think Watchmen is great. His Owls of Ga'Hoole movie, I think, is a criminally underrated animated film. It is absolutely great. I've only seen it once, but I really liked it when I saw it. And I really, yeah, really disliked everything he did for DC. Sucker Punch is three absolutely amazing and one really, really good fight scene in search of a story that would make them make sense. It would be best. I would love it if I could get those four fight scenes just by themselves so I could just watch those four fight scenes and ignore the rest of the movie. But all of his DC stuff, Man of Steel, Batman versus Superman, Dawn of Justice.
This is a pretty rough list ever since 2009.
Yeah, I didn't like any of those. His zombie movie for Netflix was spectacular looking, but just had an awful story and some awful concepts. And I feel like I'm missing some other movies in there somewhere. And then there's Rebel Moon. Zack Snyder is an amazing visual director. He knows how to put gorgeous and moving images on the screen, but the man cannot write. He just can't. He should not be allowed to write. And he also is not a cinematographer. And in both his zombie movie, which is Army of the Dead, am I wrong about that?
Army of the Dead.
We reviewed it.
I mean, Dawn of the Dead from 2004.
So I'm pretty sure it's Army of the Dead, where they go into Las Vegas. And
yes, I didn't know that was Zack Snyder, but that's on the list. Army of the Dead, 2021.
Yeah.
What an amazing premise, completely blown. Yes. Don't let him write anything.
You shouldn't let him write anything, and he needs to stop trying to be his own cinematographer because he's no damn good at it. He's worse writer than he is cinematographer, so if you want to take that for the tepid endorsement that it is. Rebel Moons, both of them look just amazing. They're gorgeous. The shots are, they're some of, you know, some of the most beautiful things have been put to film, but they're dead. They're lifeless. That's what they are, beginning to end. They are lifeless and they're dead, and they just sit there on the screen and they don't move you at all. You don't feel excited. At least I didn't. Didn't feel excited. Didn't feel moved. Didn't care about the characters. He's got good action scenes, but he always has. But even his action scenes are not as exciting as the action scenes that he's had in earlier movies, precisely because you just don't care about the characters. The only action scene that was at all just amazing is the closing action scene of Rebel Moon, which is a fabulous action scene that is the best lightsaber action scene since the original Star Wars trilogy. And I'm absolutely sincere about that. It's better than anything in the prequel trilogy or the sequel trilogy or anything since then. Best lightsaber action scene since the original Star Wars trilogy. But it's not worth watching. Not worth sitting through all of the whole 2 hours of Rebel Moon 2 to get to it. It might be worth fast-forwarding through them all to watch it if you want to see a really great lightsaber battle. I mean, they're not technically lightsabers. They're swords. They're energy swords that light up. But it's a cool scene. It's quick. It's different. It moves. It's fun. And you're like, wow, this is the Zack Snyder I've been missing. Where the hell has this guy been for the entire rest of the movie? I want to describe something for you. And I'm sorry if people are going to tune out of this podcast at this description, but believe me, you're going to want to listen to this description because I'm going to be making a very specific and important point about Rebel Moon Part 2. Wheat grows in fields on long stalks, and at the top of the stalks are the grains. And the grains have tall pieces of you know, grass or whatever coming out of them. And in order to harvest the grains, at least by hand, you take a scythe that is a long curved metal blade on the end of a long piece of wood that has two handles, and it's specifically curved to hold it in two arms, and then you swing the scythe. The scythe cuts down the wheat, and the wheat falls into a field. Once it falls into a field, people coming along after the person who has cut the grain gather the wheat stalks together and bind them up in bundles called sheaves, and then they place the sheaves upright in the field. And then a wagon comes along and people pick up the sheaves and toss them into the back of the wagon. Then people take the sheaves from the back of the wagon and toss them into an area where they walk back and forth on these stalks, which allows them to stomp off the little grains from the stalks, and they throw the straw away. These grains are gathered in baskets and tossed into the air so that pieces of straw fly away, and all that you are left with is the actual grains, which is what you want to eat. Then these grains are taken to a mill, they're dumped down, and a millstone spins around and grinds the grains into flour, which is then dumped into big bags and stacked for future use in cooking food. And you're wondering what the hell was the point of me describing each and every individual step of that process. And I'm going to tell you that each and every individual step of that process was filmed for this movie.
Are you serious?
And presented on screen in slow-mo. And however long it may have felt, however painful it may have felt, to sit through me describing it to you, and I tried to make it as fast as I could, believe me, it could not possibly have felt as long as it did to watch it as part of this movie. Do you understand the point I am making here?
This is great. Warpig, you've given me and everyone else the perfect Rebel Moon experience. I now know exactly how you felt.
I did not understand. Why? That was in the movie. I did not understand it. I don't understand it. I watched it. And what I thought was, if this was a documentary on the BBC about life in 1300s England, and some guy with a British accent was describing this process to me, and I was being educated, I would feel like this was a fulfilling moment in my life. That my life was not being wasted. That is not what I felt like. I felt like the opposite of that. Like Zack Snyder was wasting precious minutes of my time. I don't know if he was trying to draw a contrast between the bucolic farm life of this village and the mechanical regimented military life of the soldiers who were coming to crush the village, even extending that as an explanation is being too kind to the movie, because no such thematic contrast is drawn out in the movie. There is no corresponding material in the movie that would make that apparent. There's no shots of soldiers polishing their gear or loading their guns or being yelled at by sergeants or loading up or putting on uniforms or shaving their heads to draw some kind of contrast. That at least would have been a contrast and a thematic congruence. That is mere speculation on my part. And in doing so, I am being entirely too kind. I'm making an excuse. I feel embarrassed and ashamed for making that excuse because I'm extending to the movie a courtesy that it does not deserve, a courtesy that it hasn't earned. I'm trying to impute to Zack Snyder motivations that are not apparent in the movie. There is no motivation in the movie for this material. It just is there. It's long and it's painful and it's just there, and there's no reason why it's there. There could be a reason why it's there. I've just given a very good one, but it's not there.
That's absurd.
It is absurd. It's completely absurd. This movie does not stand on its own. It's the second half of a longer movie. They tried to make the first movie stand on its own, and it kind of does, but put together, they are both not worth 4 hours, and there is apparently an R-rated version that's going to be 6 hours long.
Say what now?
There's a director's cut that takes place in an alternate universe with different character motivations. I'm not making this up. I swear I am not making this up. There's a director's cut version that has like sex scenes and stuff and more graphic violence that is coming, that's going to be even longer with...
Don't we call that the Snyder Cut?
Yeah.
Those are Snyder Cuts.
And then there's supposed to be 4 more Rebel Moon movies. And they kind of set up another Rebel Moon movie. I'm telling you, I haven't described this entire movie to you. It's the Seven Samurai in space. It's A Bug's Life in space. It's Battle Beyond the Stars. But honestly, if you want a science fiction version of The Seven Samurai, just go watch Battle Beyond the Stars. It's a Roger Corman movie. It was made with a low budget, but it's better than these two movies that really just form one piece of a longer movie. Trust me about this. It's better than these two movies. All of its flaws, low budget, noted. These are not good movies. They have fabulous special effects. They have a big budget. Apparently, they're very successful for Netflix at being what they are. But other than being gravestones by the side of the highway, marking the descent of Zack Snyder's career, they are not notable in any way. They are not memorable in any way. I can't think of anything to recommend them. I can recommend 300. I can recommend Watchmen. I can recommend the 2004 Dawn of the Dead. I can recommend the 4 fighting scene. I can recommend you watch Sucker Punch for the 4 fighting scenes. I just can't recommend. I can recommend that you watch Man of Steel for Henry Cavill's performance and for the fight scenes, which are really good. I can give you a kind of a qualified recommend for Dawn of Justice and say it's an okay movie. It's not great, but it's kind of mediocre. I can't recommend this movie, either of them, taking it as a whole. It brings to mind, I saw somebody post this the other day, of all of Quentin Tarantino's movies. He's really made 10 movies. He considers Kill Bill one movie that they chopped in half because it was 4 hours long, kind of like Rebel Moon. And I look at Quentin Tarantino's 10 movies, and in my opinion, those are 10 movies of higher or lower qualities, 10 good movies to fabulous masterpiece level movies, and one clunker. And as a writer, he's written True Romance, which I love. And I just... I look at Quentin Tarantino's output and Zack Snyder's output, and I'm like, man, I would call myself a Zack Snyder fan, but was it 2009 when the last of his movies that I even kind of can recommend came out?
Yeah, that was Watchmen. And Watchmen was decent, in my opinion. Watchmen was decent. That was it. 2006 was 300. Watchmen was 2009. And, Legend of the Guardians was 2010. And Sucker Punch was 2011. And even by then, like you said, it's a few good action movies strung together. He's just not, I mean, his movies aren't that great.
So, I'm even a
Man of Steel apologist. I think it's a better movie than everybody says, but it's still a terrible Superman movie. And I can't recommend it.
It's just Rebel Moon 1 is better than Rebel Moon 2. Rebel Moon 2 doesn't have a plot. It doesn't have a story. It is just the preparation of the village for the final fight and the final fight. It's like the act 3 of the movie. So making it its own movie was a disaster. It didn't need to be its own movie. It didn't need to be as long as it was. Absolutely did not, and I can't recommend it. I'm done. There is no universe in which I could tell you that you should go watch this movie. I just can't.
Wow.
Not in good conscience. If you want to fast forward through it till you get to the part where she's about to leave the ship and has her final countdown, that's a cool fight. That's a fight worth seeing. If you have Netflix, fast forward to close to the end when she has a final fight. That's awesome.
Brutal.
That's a great fight scene. If you're a fan of fight scenes, you want to watch a good fight scene, that's a good fight scene. I will say this. Here's some other things. He doesn't use shaky cam. You can tell what's going on. And I don't mean just in an individual sense. Like, there is a battle going on, and you can tell what's going on in the battle. Side A makes a move, and that sets up a tactical situation, and side B responds to it, and they adjust to the situation and start fighting back, whereupon side A makes another response to it. The battle is not confusing. He knows how to stage an entire battle, not just an individual fight scene. So he knows how to do that, not just action. And that was well done. You have to give him props for that. That doesn't make the movie good, but he does do that well, and far too many directors in Hollywood don't. Yeah. That's about it.
Dang. I'm not surprised. In case you're curious, it's also getting really bad reviews everywhere. where reviews are read and or aggregated. It's just not very popular, which is too bad. We need good space stuff.
Here's the thing. All of those shots of grain, of harvesting grain and stuff, are gorgeous. They are absolutely beautiful shots. Just phenomenal. But they're just wasted time. I think he's become just so enamored of beauty in those shots that he's just forgotten why he's there as a director.
Yep.
I mean, they really are just, I cannot describe to you how beautiful those shots were, but they're wasted time in this kind of movie because they're not what you're there for. So anyways, three body problem, which we discussed a little bit last week. And I was kind of confused as to what three body was on Amazon Prime and what three body problem was on Netflix. So let me give you the rundown. There was a book written by a Chinese author called, in English, Three Body Problem. And it was translated into English and won a Hugo in 2015. And a Chinese company called Tencent, which you may know because they apparently own 10% of every gaming company, every video game company on the planet now. They made a Chinese language version of it in China with all Chinese actors. So the story, that version of it, I tried to watch after I got done watching Netflix version. It has 30 episodes, each of them an hour long. So I'm guessing that covers the entire book. I couldn't get through a full entire episode of it. It was so boring.
So boring.
The characters are different. The characters, the situation was different. It's set entirely in China. So from this, I deduce that the Netflix version, which is set in London with British and Chinese and American characters, has been significantly altered from the original Chinese novel, of which I know nothing. So I cannot, I am inferring, I am guessing that this has been altered from the Chinese novel for the purposes of making a Netflix movie that is more palatable to a Western audience. That it's being set in London so that people will like it more. I don't know if the translation of the novel was also altered, or if the Chinese novel was set in London and they altered it, if Tencent altered it for, you know, to make it a Chinese TV show. I don't know how all that worked. You'll have to forgive me. But the Netflix TV show. So we have four. There's Chinese novel, English novel, Netflix show, Amazon Prime show. The Netflix show is only 8 episodes. It does not cover the entire novel. It stops on kind of an anticlimactic moment. That is, let me tell you, a little bit of a letdown. Oh, that's a terrible place to stop. And it's a rough ride for our characters. My my comrade at arms here really hated it and didn't get through, like, what, two episodes?
Didn't even finish the first one. No, finished the first one. And that was enough for me.
You found it boring.
It was dreadfully boring. And I didn't care to see any of the characters anymore for the rest of the series.
The show begins with a bunch of physicists in the world, like 30-something international level physicists, apparently going insane and killing themselves. And people are investigating these suicides, and it's built up as a mystery, and I found the mystery compelling. I found, and the show kept on presenting new mysteries that would go on. Another physicist starts seeing this countdown in front of her eyes. Like she just sees these glowing letters hanging in the air that starts counting down. And we know another one of the physicists who killed himself by clawing at his eyes and then writing on the wall, "I still see the countdown." He wrote in blood on the wall this countdown and ended up killing himself. So we're like, "Oh, he killed himself." And then another physicist tosses herself into the cooling tank of a Cherenkov pool. And all these things are going on. And I found the mysteries interesting, and they kept on stringing them out. It starts off with a big scene of a struggle assassin in the Red Army. In the a struggle session in China during one of the Maoist Red Guard People's Revolutions. I think it's a great cultural revolution. And these things are kept me interested enough. There was only one episode where I was really truly bored, like, "Come on, guys, get going." So it depends on if you find the mysteries interesting at all. And there were enough things that were presented to me that I found it compelling that kept me going along. So it was worth it to me to keep going beyond just doing it for the show. But it wasn't super compelling. It was enough to hold my interest, but not super compelling. It wasn't edge of the seat compelling. It was like, okay, I can keep watching this. It was about the same level of compelling. I've been watching The Good Place. It was about the same level of mild interest that I have in watching The Good Place. Where it's like, okay, this is barely interesting enough to keep watching. And it's not badly done. There are some really great scenes in it. One of the characters makes nanowires, and if you know what nanowires are, nanofibers, they're used as weapons famously in like Shadowrun and other role-playing games. And they get used at one point in the show, and it's a brilliant sequence. Just amazing to see what they do with it, and I loved it. It was almost worth watching the show just to get to that scene. It's just great. And it is absolutely karmic justice. Loved it. So if you've ever wanted to see nanowires used in the way that you think they might could be used at some point, and that's a bit of a spoiler, sorry. There are payoffs. The show sets things up and pays them off. It's not all an entire season of tease. It sets up mysteries and then pays the mysteries off and sets up new mysteries and pays those mysteries off and sets up other mysteries and pays those mysteries off, and things get explained. So in that sense, it is at least unique among streaming shows that tend to set up mysteries and try to keep you hanging for the entire season and then never pay them off and say, okay, next season we'll pay off the mysteries. Or in the season finale, we'll pay off the mysteries or whatever. The show actually does things with the mysteries it sets up. At one point, you know, it introduces this VR game, and you're like, what's going on in this VR game? What's happening? Are they going to solve the puzzles? What are these puzzles for? And it pays off those mysteries. And whether or not you find the show compelling depends on whether or not you find the answers to those mysteries interesting. But they do pay those off. So they're there. They do give you those answers. So at least it is worthwhile on that level. I found it worth watching. I enjoyed it. There are shows that I've enjoyed more, but I did enjoy this show, and it is so much better. People may tell you, hey, you know, they've got a bunch of foreign language shows, and the foreign language shows are better than the Netflix adaptations. In this case, based on my experience, this Netflix adaptation is infinitely superior to the Chinese language one on Amazon Prime. But if you'd like to challenge me on that, please go ahead. I'd be interested in hearing anyone who watched all 30 episodes of the Amazon Prime show, what you thought. Knock yourself out. So I would recommend Three Body Problem. It sets up mysteries. It pays off the mysteries. And you do have to realize it's written by a Chinese hard sci-fi author writing in communist China. So there is a lot of anti-religious, but not a lot. There is present in the show anti-religious, rah-rah science statements done at several points during the show. People openly state, you know, religion is false, science is real. We depend on science now. We've evolved past religion. I'm sure John can give more accurate quotes on
that's,
that.
That's exactly where I, you know, I decided that I wasn't interested in seeing the rest of it. The first episode was boring, but it did set up that central mystery of the countdown and the physicists killing themselves and going mad. So I was thoroughly boring and I didn't like any of the characters, but the one thing that made me not want to find out what happened with the mysteries is we had two characters, and this isn't a communist struggle session. This is the characters, like two of the main characters, speaking, and one of them says, this is the main character from the past. There's sort of like a past and a present. The main character from the past says to the main character of the present, you know, we've got no use for God. This house is full of scientists. Something along those lines. That was the line. The lie is we have no use for God. This is scientists. And it being outside of a struggle session. And
I will tell you this. Her point of view is expanded on later in the show in a really amazing way. And what she's saying is not just anti-religious propaganda on the part of the author of on part of the writer of the show. You get to see that character from a different point of view, and you get to see what she's saying. And I don't want to spoil it, but she gets a really hard knock in her point of view and why she's saying that. And I can tell you more when we're off the air, because I don't want to spoil it for the listeners. But if you're not going to watch it, I'll tell you more when we get off the
air. I suspected as much, but this was the main character talking about it to the other main character.
Yeah.
And even if they were going to pay it off slightly differently, I don't have time in my life anymore for that shit. I don't have time in my life for authors like that.
Anti-religious propaganda.
I do not have time in my life for that, and neither do you. Just walk away. As soon as you sense the evil, it's okay. There's a million other things to watch. I sat down with my wife, and we watched monster movies instead. Actually, been going through the old Godzillas. Not the old ones yet. We haven't gotten to the old ones yet. But life's too short, man. And my tolerance for that kind of evil is at zero. And I recommend it to you, Warpig, and everybody listening. The mysteries are not worth it. But at least you recognize it as propaganda. And so perhaps it's not directly harmful, for lack of a better word. I've said my piece.
I would say that I would have to know more about the story of the novel to know whether that actually qualifies as anti-religious propaganda. Just because you have a character who believes those things and says those things doesn't mean the work as a whole is anti-religious propaganda. But I'm not criticizing you for dipping out. I'm not criticizing you for having no tolerance for it, because we live in a time where, here's the thing. We live in a time where things like that are so common and they're so obvious and they're so frequent that if you have a low tolerance for it, that's only to be expected. And so I'm not criticizing anyone who heard that and said, well, that's it, I don't want to watch. That's perfectly fine. I have a different degree of tolerance for things like that, because different person, different experiences. And so whether or not the work as a whole is anti-religious propaganda, I don't know. And also I have a different set of criteria for whether or not something is valuable for me to watch, because for me, whether or not I can review something for the show determines whether or not it's valuable for me to watch. So, and on that level, it entertained me. It wasn't painful. I watched the whole thing. I have been tortured by shows that I've had to review for this show. This show at least kept me entertained for the 8 hours I watched it.
Good. I'm actually glad that you got something out of it. And I was worried they weren't going to pay any of that stuff off.
And that character's journey through the show, their character arc, what she says when she goes through that, I'm not saying it makes it worth it, but it's not the simplistic statement it seems on the surface based on what happened in the original. thing. But to be fair to the show, other characters make similar pronouncements. So I'm not trying to defend it against that charge of being irreligious or unreligious or anti-religious either. I don't know. One way or the other. I am on the question of whether the three-body problem as a book or as a whole is, it is not pro-religion, the Netflix show is. But I don't think that is the sole determinant of quality. I was entertained. There were enough interesting science fiction concepts in it to keep me involved. There were enough interesting moments. But you're right, the main characters, most of them are kind of disagreeable. They're a little
not in a warrior kind of way, not that kind of disagreeable.
Not in a fun way. No, not in a entertaining way. You don't feel empathy for the main characters. You don't ever really feel like you're getting close to them. They're all really prickly people.
Yeah, prickly is a good word for
them. We're out of time. We're really, really out of time. So let me say this. A lot of modern writers seem to mistake being prickly and easily offended as strength, as standing up for yourself. And so they make prickly characters. And I sense a lot of that in this show. I sense a lot of that in that many of the characters have that as a character trait, not that it's overwhelming. It's just every character seems to have a touch of that added into their other characteristics. It's common to all the characters, even though it's not their defining characteristic. The person who wrote this probably isn't aware that they have a bias towards that, but they write their characters to be prickly, even if they're trying to make them something else. Even if they're trying to make this person really friendly and nice, they're still kind of prickly, whether or not the writer is aware of it. Because there is a friendly and nice character, but even he is a little bit prickly. And I think it's because the writer themselves, whoever adapted it, is a little bit prickly. So
yeah, I think you're right.
I would still recommend Three Body Problem.
Cool.
And we had talked about this before the show, and I wanted to draw out the anti-religious bit because Dornall had talked to me about it, and I felt like I wanted to give him a fair chance to make that point. So was there anything else that you wanted to say about it, even though you'd only seen the first episode?
No, I definitely said my piece.
Okay.
It is what it is. Oh, I hate that phrase.
I like that phrase. Anyways, folks.
Regular Siskel and Ebert here. Anyways, yeah, good show. Good show. It was fun talking about that stuff. I loved going over the Battle Bronstein. I had a ton of fun doing that. I hope everybody... hope everybody enjoys the reviews and maybe goes, maybe skips Rebel Moon. Maybe you skip that.
Don't watch either Rebel Moon. don't. There's nothing. Don't. That's all I can recommend. I mean, I've seen worse movies. I really have seen lots of worse movies. But there's nothing in them they're not terrible movies. They're not painfully bad. They're just, there's nothing there. It's all visuals. There's nothing to them. That's it. There's nothing to them. It's all facade. It's all just pretty pictures that don't, there's no soul. There's no heart. There's no anything behind pretty pictures. So they don't move you. They don't excite you. So, all right, I'm done.
But we move and we excite you.
Yes, and, we do.
I hope you all enjoyed the show and come back for more. I'm done for the week, Daddy Warpig.
All right. I will take us out, folks. This has been Geek Gab for Monday, April 22nd, 2024. We want to thank everyone for tuning in live, participating in the jumping, driving, and wailing chat. We want to ask you to go ahead and subscribe, click the bell icon, get a notification as to when we're going live. Be sure to check out our blog, our Patreon, and our Subscribestar. Any donation to help us defray the costs of running the channel would be welcome. And we are signing out for today, folks. But don't you worry. Don't you fret. We will be back.